stands out, I think, that the covenant is more than their love. Obviously, when you're talking about God, all of his elements and attributes are united at a certain point, so you can't ever drive a wedge all the way. But I do think it's important that covenants are sort of political structures that are added to a relationship. They're not necessarily always present. And David and Jonathan are going to keep this covenant. Jonathan is not going to betray David, even though he stays loyal to his father. And David is not going to try to kill either Saul or Jonathan. He doesn't. David has the opportunity to kill Saul several times. He doesn't do it. And eventually, the fulfillment, the final fulfillment of this covenant, is in 2 Samuel chapter 9, which would otherwise be a very odd chapter. This is where they find Mephibosheth, and he's lame, and David says, you know, bring him to my court. He's going to join me. That story really doesn't make any sense if you don't understand the covenant. Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son. So Jonathan is dead, and David goes and finds Jonathan's son and brings him to his court. He says, you're joining with me. Even though your father is killed, your house is defeated, and you're lame, you know, would have been the most obvious example of someone saying, clearly Mephibosheth is just, you know, he's just really been judged. He's down and out. And David says, I'm going to honor my covenant and elevate you to join my court. And so the covenant is significant for Jonathan and David's relationship, and they keep it. They really do. David would have, in worldly thought, been justified in wiping out all of the descendants of Saul. And that's what you do when you win in a political conquest. You kill the other guy's loyalties. I mean, you just get rid of them. But David doesn't do that. He honors the covenant and really honors Mephibosheth in a way that Mephibosheth would not have had any reason to expect. Dr. Phillips.
Yes, I find this whole passage very fascinating for a number of reasons. One is that Jonathan obviously recognizes God's calling of David to be an anointing of David to be king. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it would normally be expected that Jonathan would be king following his father's footsteps. Although in Israel, kingship was elective by the tribes, so it wasn't guaranteed to the son, as we see. But nevertheless, Jonathan is recognizing that he will not be king and David will be king. Mm-hmm. And that is really a great exercise of faith. God has called David, and really, in a sense, self-denial. I'm not going to fight for this because I recognize God's will.
That's right.
So it's sort of like, you know, not my will, but yours be done.
Absolutely.
What Jonathan is saying here by making this covenant with David, recognizing him and then asking for, again, you know, mercy for his house.
And this is going to come up with Saul's reaction a little bit later. He tells Jonathan, don't you understand what you're doing? As long as the son of Jesse lives, you're not going to inherit the throne. And you know, Saul is very upset about that. But Jonathan, as you say, is accepting him.
Yeah, and that shows, of course, also Saul's rejection of God's calling to David.
Absolutely.
But another thing I find very fascinating about this passage is we know what went on. You know, how do we know that? Obviously, there were witnesses to David and Jonathan's conversation.
Right.
So the assumption is that David at some point told Samuel. Samuel was personally keeping track of all of these things.
Yes, I think that that is fair because David is checking in with Samuel periodically. And yeah, it's one of those curious things, you know, who told whom to get it out here, but we do know. And Jonathan is a character that his role is often dramatically reduced. I mean, usually people just say he was a good friend. It's good to have friends, but it's so much more than that. I mean, Jonathan is forfeiting the throne. He is giving up what he could have, in a certain perspective, said was his rightful claim to the throne for David, because God has moved to David. Absolutely. And it's very important. David honors Saul's kingship, so there's a balancing act. At no point does David think that it would be legitimate to just kill Saul or take over. And in fact, when he hears that Saul has been killed, he kills the messenger. So he's very, very, very staunchly pro-office, you know, respecting the office. But at the same time, the fact that David is the successor shows us that it's the Lord who gives the office. It isn't inherited. And so Jonathan goes on to assist David against his father. We mentioned this a little bit a couple of weeks ago. This is what you might call sort of black market, gray market activity, right? I mean, he's going to be loyal to Saul. He's never going to defect and join David. But there are certain times in which he's going to subvert Saul's will to protect David. So there is something of a model here of Christian resistance, and it's a juggling act. It's not complete rebellion, but it is at certain times and occasions sort of thwarting political will when it is immoral, when it is contrary to God's desires to protect those who would be taken advantage of. And so Jonathan first does this in chapter 19 when he intercedes on behalf of David. He goes, talks to his father, and he says, you know, you shouldn't do this. David has not sinned against you. His works are good. He's done all this good stuff. And so that's not really anything. There's nothing wrong about that or dangerous, except maybe Saul would have been so mad, you know, that he would have lashed out. But in that section, that's just an ordinary act of intercession. Hey, David's been good. You shouldn't kill him. And Saul agrees. But then when we get to chapter 20, it's overtly subversive. Jonathan and David meet together, and they talk about what's going to happen. And David says, basically, your father's trying to kill me. Saul is going to kill me. And the problem is that there is a feast coming up, the Feast of the New Moon in verse 5. And David is going to be expected to be here. If he's not here, then that will be a problem, that, and Saul will have sort of reason to call David a traitor. David has already decided that he can't go back to Saul. That's been made clear. Saul's tried to kill him twice now. But Saul, at least, expects David to still be around. So we haven't gotten so far down the road yet that everybody knows David's not going to be there. Chapter 20, verse 5. David said to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me, that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he says thus, it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he is angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father?" So, appealing to the covenant, and if your father is satisfied with your explanation, then I'll know that it's safe to come back. But if he is angry with your explanation, then I know he's trying to kill me. And so this is the arrangement. David's going to wait, not go to the feast, have Jonathan give a false report, I mean, let's be honest, and then decide what's happening here. And this is what lets David know that it's over, really, for him and Saul. That if Saul reacts this way, then Saul's definitely going to kill him, so he can't go back. And this is why they make their agreement about shooting of the arrows. Usually this is the story people appeal to talk about their friendship. But again, it's political friendship. I mean, the arrow ritual is just is code. I mean, it's sort of, espionage, right? Let me send Jonathan in and find out some information, and he'll come back to me. Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for if I that you had done evil, if I knew that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, would I not tell you?" And David said to Jonathan, "Well, who will tell me? What if your father answers you roughly?" So they're trying to figure out how to give the message. And they talk about shooting the arrows, and they reaffirm the covenant. And the arrow ritual is that David will wait in the field. And after Jonathan has got his information, he and a servant will come out to the field. He'll shoot his arrow and send a servant to go get it. And if he leads his servant to where the arrow is, serving his arrow, and comes back and it's all normal, then David will understand that the coast is clear. But if Jonathan shoots the arrow and tells the servant, "Way out there, keep going," and you know, misleads the servant on a wild goose chase, to where it's taking the servant a long time, he's not finding the arrow, then David will know that it's bad, that Saul is out to kill him. And he will then leave. And initially, it appears that the idea is that this keeps some distance between the two men. But what I find really curious is, you know, when it actually goes down, they end up meeting up and talking anyway. So I'm not really sure what to make of that. But originally, the idea is sort of to mask their discourse, to keep some distance here. And so they make the vow again, and they agree to it. David does not go to the new moon festival, but Jonathan does. And David is waiting out there to see what will happen. And so it goes down. Jonathan goes. David is in the field. The king sits down to eat at the feast. So we're verse 24 and following. David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. So Abner is the original general with Saul. They're sitting by the wall, which is where you sit when you're in a political situation. You judge by the gates, sitting by the wall. And for the first day, David's seat is empty. And Saul did not say anything. He thought, "Something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean." So cleanliness and uncleanliness is something that David would have gone through all the time, right? I mean, he's a soldier, so anytime he's around dead bodies, he's going to be unclean for a while. And anytime he's with his wife, he's going to be unclean. So being unclean is not a scandal. You can't come to the feast while you're unclean, but wait. Wash, then come. But as it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, Saul said to Jonathan, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today?" So now something is wrong. When you're invited to eat with the king, you're supposed to come. And maybe you can't get there the one day, though even that's stretching it probably for normal people, but you don't come the second day, and that gets attention. And Saul says, "What's going on? Why isn't he here?" And so Jonathan gives him the answer that they had rehearsed. "David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, 'Please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers.' Therefore, he has not come to the king's table." And then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." Now, this response from Saul is stronger than the translators let on. And, you know, my translation is fairly literal. It just kind of is delicate. Some translations are particularly weak, though. I saw one that just said, "You stupid traitor." Which is not what he's saying. He's saying, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." So basically, "I am not your father. Someone else has brought you here, and this is why you're disloyal to me."
Smoking the bandit.
There are potential parallels there. And that's what this business about the shame of your mother's nakedness means. He's saying, you're proving to be a false son, which means I'm not your father. Some other man is your father. And so you're disgracing your mother by proving this. Now, I don't think that anybody thinks that Saul meant that. I mean, this is just, he's angry. He's lashing out.
This is, in ours says, as in modern, similar modern expressions, we insult his meant for Jonathan and not necessarily his mother.
That's right. Yes, the insult was for Jonathan, and it's because he's angry, and it's because Jonathan, he knows Jonathan is being disloyal. You know, Jonathan is breaking his trust, and so it's sort of a statement of being disowned, you know, like, you're not my son, and you are shaming your mother by doing this to me. And the complaint, again, is that if you don't let me kill David, then you won't inherit the kingdom. And so you're dishonoring the whole family. And he says, bring him here, he will surely die. And in the Hebrew, literally, and I enjoy some of these phrasings, it says, he is a son of death. So, you know, David is already dead, basically, in my mind. I just have to carry it out. And so Jonathan tries to speak up for David. He tries to defend him. Why should he be killed? What has he done? But Saul is not in a mood to talk anymore. And so he grabs that spear, which is, you know, a common thing these days. And he throws it at Jonathan, his own son. And so Jonathan got out of there. He rose from the table in fierce anger. Ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. So the throwing of the spear is the same thing Saul had done to David, and potentially could have killed him. You know, unlikely that Saul really wanted his son to die, but in these fits of anger and, you know, stuff can happen. Yes?
Did Saul just know he was lying?
I think, yes. You know, I think Saul is crazy, but he's not dumb. And so Saul knows that David is on the run beforehand, I think. And he's starting to suspect that Jonathan is siding with David. And I think this is just sort of confirms it. There's no point where it actually explains that they had proof. They figured it out. I think, you know, Saul's just putting it together.
He's, but would it have mattered? Does Jonathan get to give David the permission to skip the feast?
Well, no, not from Saul's perspective.
Right, so, like, even if it were true, even if David had asked him, it's still a betrayal of Saul's authority.
Yeah.
For Jonathan to say, yeah, sure, you can do it.
Yeah,
that's
I mean,
right.
He was upset that he skipped out on his
shin. Yeah. I think that expression, though, when he says, "You have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame," he is saying, you know, I know you're loyal to David. So even if this story might be true, you know, you're taking David's side. And that is unacceptable. And so he reacts in the way that confirms his intention to kill David. He'd already said he was going to. And so Jonathan leaves in fierce anger. And this is an amazing, I mean, this is a big deal, obviously, but it's even more amazing when you consider Jonathan's going to come back. Jonathan is eventually going to come back and be with Saul and still fight for him. But this is a big deal. It's a dishonor, public disgrace. Jonathan is angry. He storms away. He does not eat at the feast. And so in royal court ritual, this is a huge disruption. This is not ordinarily anything that you would allow. So in the morning, Jonathan goes out to the field, and they do what they said they're going to do. He shoots the arrow, and he shoots it beyond him. And has him go run out there, and he tells him keep going, and he misleads him, so he is running way, way out in the field, and finally comes back. And so that's the signal that that Saul is angry, that Saul is going to kill David. But what's curious here, and I don't know what to make of this other than, you know, just these two men are emotional. Jonathan gives all the weapons to the little boy, the lad, says, all right, get out of here, go back to the city. And then he goes and meets with David. So in one sense, it seems like the whole ritual, I mean, it becomes unnecessary after they meet.
He could have just gone out by himself.
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason they had this ritual, it appeared to be, was so that there could be a little bit of plausible deniability, some safety, but they just forego all of that. As soon as the lad leaves, David runs, comes to Jonathan, falls to the ground. So I guess David is the one who initiates the meeting up. He's emotional. Bows three times. They kiss one another, weep together, but David more so. So David is the one who is completely torn, falling to pieces over this. And then Jonathan says to David, go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So this was their last time together, really. They're crying, they're emotional. David seems to be the more so. So he's the one who rushes towards Jonathan. But then they part. Now, this instance, as well as some of those other phrases, has given occasion recently for what I think is a ridiculous point of view, but one you will hear often now, that these two men were lovers. And I don't know how many of you have heard that, but it's not uncommon now to say that Jonathan and David were lovers, and in fact, gay lovers, because they're kissing, they love each other, and their loyalty is surpassing others. And so you can see the instances where the Bible does say they loved each other. 1 Samuel 18:1, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. They're soulmates, right? So their souls come together. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. 1 Samuel 19:1, Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. Samuel 20, verse 17, they made a vow because he loved him. And then what we just read, they kiss. And then in 2 Samuel 1:26, in the song of Saul and Jonathan's death, when David writes the song praising them, you know, how the mighty have fallen, Jonathan says this. I'm sorry, David says this. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. And so that's usually the big one that people camp out on. They say, well, there you go. I mean, how could a love ever be surpassing the love a man has for women? And you'll see this. I mean, people today assume that that verse is obvious, and it's a clincher. And, I mean, you know, you just have to be fooling yourself to not see that these two men were lovers. And so we need to have some response to this. But I think our response to this is also important, not only for answering a controversy, but it actually opens up a bigger view of love and friendship that we have really, to our detriment, lost. And so what to say about this? I think the first thing to note is that these passages were never controversial in the history of the church or Judaism until now. Nobody thought that this meant these guys were gay. They didn't edit it. You know, I mean, it's not like we're having to go back to the Hebrew and dig it out. I mean, it's right here in the English. Your love surpasses the love of women. And so no one felt a burden to defend these verses. They thought there was nothing to see here. And we know that in other places in the Bible, the translators did sometimes kind of squirm when they get to places that were a little too gross, a little too sexual. They would do euphemisms, you know, they would get away from something sometimes. But these were not passages that were problematic. No one felt the need to censor this. And, you know, let's be honest, there's no reason to question David's heterosexual appetites, right? I mean, there's a lot of evidence in the Bible that David was fond of women and had no problem going that direction. So, he can't be completely gay. That's outrageous. We know he had heterosexual appetites. It's also completely incredible, and I mean that in the strict sense. Like, it's not credible that earlier audiences would have read these verses as meaning they were gay and not tried to change it. It's just not possible. No one would have been okay with that. The rest of the Bible is clear that homosexual activity is a sin all throughout Old Testament and New, and certainly throughout the history of the church. So they wouldn't have left these verses unedited or uncensored if they interpreted them as meaning that these men were gay. And that is very important for us to say, not because the old days were better and we're dumb, but because we have lost a category so that we can't make sense of these verses except in a sexual way. And the category we've lost is the friend love. That friendship is not just liking one another, but in fact, friends can love one another. And that is actually all over the ancient world. I mean, that's a big deal. Friends love each other in a very deep way. And in our world, we've lost that category because we are on the other side of the sexual revolution. And so every time we hear love, we think first of all about sex, and then second of all, we'll think parent to child. Right, familial love. But the idea that you might love your friend in a deep way, surpassing the love of women, most of us probably are not used to that kind of language. Now, it's not completely erased across the globe. In the Mediterranean world, men will still kiss each other. In the Middle Eastern world, they hold hands. You know, there was a famous picture of President Bush and the Saudi king holding hands together, and everybody thought that was just, you know, kind of silly in America, but that's what they do in the Middle East, you know. They hold hands, they hug, they kiss, they wear each other's clothes. And again, we all see that and we say, that's gay, right? That's our reaction as Americans. That must be gay. But no, the problem is with us, not with them. We have sexualized everything when in the history of the world, there was a love that was a friend love that was even passionate. I mean, we can use that kind of language, but it was not erotic. And that's a very important point. It's in ancient literature. You see male friendship that is very, very important. I gave you a couple, but I forgot one of the big ones is in the Iliad, Achilles, and what's his... his squire's name, I forgot now. In the Iliad, you remember? Achilles, you know, the guy who ends up getting killed, which makes Achilles go so crazy in beast mode and go kill Hector. Anyway, I forget his name now, but he's got a male companion who is his best friend, and they are tight. They are brothers. They are friends.
We're doing the same thing with him now.
Well, right, unfortunately, we do. In fact, the much, much maligned Plato Symposium is completely about getting rid of homoeroticism in favor of friendship. People always say Socrates and Plato are gay. Well, always. I say it today. It's actually not what's going on in the symposium. If you read the symposium, Socrates is talking to guys who engage in homoerotic behavior and saying you should stop that. And he says there's actually a love that's better than that. It's a love that, what do we call it? Platonic love. You've all heard of that, right? The relationship is strictly platonic. So how in the world have we gotten to the point where platonic love used to mean non-erotic, right? I mean, we still use that. It's strictly platonic. But we've got mass, amnesia here. And so now we think platonic love is erotic. It's simple. It's because of our culture. We live in a sexualized culture that doesn't have a category for friend love.
These are ancient, but mm-hmm. it just went away. In the history of the world, because you have these letters between Henry VIII and Charles Brandon, and that's only 500 years ago, and they are
absolutely
super important to each other.
Yeah.
Love each other.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, though, that, like the sexual revolution, that homosexuality and other deviant sexual things are more public now. And so, for people who are good and don't want to be associated with that, the deal is you just move far away from it as you can, so the appearance won't.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, two tough guys aren't going to hold hands together, even having the appearance of holding hands together.
There's a prudential way to do that, but then there's also the childish way, right? I mean, we see this all the time with kids. They go, that's gross.
Right.
And so we have to be careful here. Obviously, there would be certain things that would be unwise to do today. You know, I wouldn't advise you to go out and kiss another man in public without anticipating reaction. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with being emotional and even, loving and all that love can mean towards your friends. You can hug them, right? I mean, that's no problem. And we see, again, little kids still do some of this, right? They like to dress alike. You know, there's a development pattern there. And at a certain point, they can't do that anymore because they'll get made fun of. But, you know, at a certain stage in their development, they want to do that. They enjoy doing that. And we mentioned this a little bit in our Philippians study. Friendship was understood to be at the foundation of political thought. A good city had to be founded on friendship. And that is a very, very important doctrine in the ancient world. And so David and Jonathan have a sort of quasi-political covenant relationship. They love each other. They're friends. This all is consistent with that ancient conception of friend love. Elaine?
It happened a little bit more recently than that. Wasn't that the whole concept behind the Quakers found in Philadelphia?
Sort of. The Quakers, of course, they put their own spin to it. But yes, yeah, that's right. The city of brotherly love. So founding a city on love. In the ancient world, of course, that was not understood to outlaw violence and force and military. And that's what the Quakers kind of did. They said, since it's friendship, we won't have the meaner parts of the city. So that's where they went different. But you're right. I mean, they even refer to themselves as a community of friends. Mm-hmm. Davey?
Thinking with English, we're somewhat of a disadvantage because mm-hmm. we have one word for love.
Yeah.
But I know Greek has three or four words, doesn't Hebrew as well. And what's in the text? And one means brotherly love, one means erotic.
Hebrew does not have all of those words like Greek and Latin does. Hebrew does have, it has the love word that is translated sort of covenantal favor or grace. You get that a bit, but it doesn't actually have the specific ones like in Greek. In Greek you have philia, which is the general love, and then you have eros, which is the sexual love, and then you have agape, which is a sort of self-sacrificial love. Of course, there's a fourth one, because C.S. Lewis's book is called The Four Loves. I've forgotten the fourth Greek name, but
Storge?
That's
love
it.
Love of a man for his dog or something.
Storgeia, that's right. And so what these are there's the erotic passionate love, which we're familiar with. There's the love of sort of family love. There's a love of friendship, companionship, and then there's sort of the charity, right? The self-sacrificial giving. So those are the four different kinds of love. And C.S. Lewis, I got this quote from The Four Loves, I think is a fantastic quote. "Those who cannot conceive friendship as a substantive love, but only as a disguise or elaboration of eros, betray the fact they've never had a friend. They use friends for their own purposes." And don't we see this all the time today, right? You're my friends because I need people to have fun with, right? I need an occasion to go out. I need people at my party, right? But am I actually going to deny myself for you? No, sorry. That's when it ends, right? And that's when it stops.
It's actually, I've read a couple of things in, I guess it's First Things or whatever, but they've had priests, Catholic priests, commenting on the fact that, you know, the priestly life, celibate life, is not necessarily a lonely life, because that removal of the sexual component does actually free you, you know, at least in theory, and that perhaps itself as shows how deep the sexualization of all relationships has become, that category, even for priests, who are explicitly banned from that, have failed.
And you see this friendship love again in the Gospels with Jesus and the disciple whom he loved, the apostle whom he loved, right? John, the beloved. And he's reclining on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper. Now, of course, Dan Brown comes in and he decodes that for us and tells us, "Aha!" But no, you know, it was no problem. And when Jesus says, "I no longer call you servants or students, but friends," well, why weren't they his friends earlier? And they sort of were, but now they're being elevated. "Greater love hath no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends." So, friend love is a big emphasis in the Bible. And we ought to reclaim friend love. And this is going to be hard, because people aren't going to understand it, and your own instincts are going to fight against it. So I'm not asking you to go kiss all of your friends, but I am asking you to consider the ways in which friend love ought to be bigger and even sort of deep soul bonding. And this is also important. I don't want to get myself or anyone else in trouble, but you will see this sometimes in marriage and friend rivalries. You know, a man might have a good friend who he really wants to hang out with all the time, and that's going to cause a rivalry with the wife, and vice versa sometimes. And the complaint will be, the wife will say, "Why can't you have that same kind of fun with me? Why can't you talk about the stuff you talk with your friends with me?" And that's really tricky, because sometimes you can. I mean, I think that's sort of everyone's ideal relationship, is that all of the loves come together. But we have to be realistic. That can only happen with your spouse, right? All of the loves cannot come together with anybody else in the world but your spouse. And they oftentimes are not all going to come together with your spouse, certainly not at the same time all the time. And we've kind of been fooled into thinking if they don't, then that love isn't right. You know, if they don't all come together and stay there, then uh-oh, you're not really in love. And that's wrong, okay? And if you don't remember anything else from, you know, Bible class teaching for your life, I think this is like it. This is the most practical thing you can hang on to. Loves have different aspects, different duties, different responsibilities. And you cannot fall for this myth that if they're not all there all the time, then it's nothing. and you can just break it all and walk away and find that other person where they will all come together. I mean, that's the great lie of modern romance, that if not every aspect of love is there, then it's false. It's completely, completely wrong. It's not historical. I mean, nobody ever thought that way until very recently, and it's not always in the Bible. I mean, David says, "My love for you has surpassed my love for women." And so we can say that was wrong, that was harsh, that was mean, but the Bible doesn't really condemn that. That's not the point of that verse, to show David's wrong, is it? It's to extol the love he had for Jonathan. We need to be honest about that. And so these loves are distinct and different and good. And what we see here is not some sort of veiled homoerotic relationship. We see a love that we forgot. We see something that our culture has completely lost to our own detriment. Pastor Nye.
I was counseling with a couple that was going to see several years ago, was going to get married, and the guy said, "How many nights do you think I should be out with the boys?" And you know, I just gave him this, you know, occasionally, yeah, I go out with the boys. But you're talking about, you know, he's wondering two nights a week, three nights a week.
Right.
How many nights a week should I be out with the boys? And I said, forget that. You know, just forget that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally you'll get out with the guys, but not a weekly.
Right. And I think that that's all part of the wisdom of figuring these things out, right? Is that your relationships have to have boundaries. So. And I think it would be a mistake to try to, you know, keep them all neatly discreet and separate, you know. I mean, that wouldn't work. But just know that this is okay. There are certain flavors and levels and aspects of these loves. And that we're the ones sort of required to be in control of these loves, not the loves controlling us, which is another real problem in modern day philosophy. If someone's in love, I mean, that's it, right? They win. You can't do anything about that. I mean, haven't we seen that again and again and again all over television and now in the marriage debates, right? Hey, you can't control who you love, and if you love it, then who are anyone else standing in your way? And so love is this trump card, and that's not true either. Love is good, but love has to be controlled, has to be harnessed. St. Augustine has this great image. He says your sort of appetites, your interest as a sort of desires are one horse on the chariot, and then your emotions are another horse on the chariot, and you've got to hold the reins, keep those horses in line. And I think that's a great image, because they'll run off. And in our day, a lot of times we promote the lie that that's great, right? The more your emotions run off, the better, truer, more authentic you are, right? And the guy who's controlling them all, well, he's the one that's living a lie. But that's false, you know. If you don't control them, they're going to run off.
Patroclus. Say his friend.
Say what?
Patroclus.
Patroclus. Yeah. Good job. That's right. Achilles' friend. Achilles' friend is Patroclus, and they are very close. And so, yes, this friend love is not something weird and unique, except for us today.
It's not even weird for us today, though. If you think about girl or women hanging out, the touching thing is not so nearly as weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they were having a sleepover or something, you know, like teenage girls, right? They're having a sleepover and, like, one's braiding the other's hair.
Yeah.
That's not weird. If two dudes were doing that, you'd be like, whoa.
Yeah.
Especially if they're like me and they don't have
that.
What would we even do?
No, and that is true that, you know, I'm a big believer in what we call sort of gender roles, right? Male and female roles. But we have to be critical about that stuff, because sometimes we really do, we just resort to a sort of juvenile thing. We're like, the guys are tough, the women are soft, and that's that. And, you know, that's not true. The roles are defined by functions and jobs and things that God defines, but you want to be faithful to that. But for a man to have a deep love of other men is a good thing. It really is. And that's going to be hard. I mean, I get it. We're going to feel weird about that. We're not, but that's biblical, okay? That's in the Bible. And so our response to the charge that Jonathan and David were somehow gay is just to simply put it back on the person making the charge and say that you actually are the one that has a weaker view of love. You have less categories than the Bible does. And our categories make better sense of this in the text. And I would encourage us to cultivate friends, to make that a real emphasis, friends that you love and then are loyal to. Ultimately, as well, you're not going to understand your relationship with God if you don't have this friend love. This is why modern evangelicalism is a little bit creepy, because the love of God that it promotes is basically erotic. I mean, that really is the love, because that's all they know about. They know father love, they know erotic love, and that's it. But if Jesus is our friend, then we're going to have friend love. And that's a huge category that we need back. And so this is a very practical teaching, and it's also a religious teaching for your relationship with God. All right, we better stop here. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for your goodness, your mercy, and your love. Thank you for your son, Jesus, who we are now privileged to call our friend. And we do thank you for this example of friend love with Jonathan and David. We ask that you would encourage us to be friends to others, to be true friends, to be loyal and faithful. Help us to follow after the good examples of Jonathan and David, to avoid their bad examples as well as those of Saul and others, and to trust in you in all that we do, understanding that you are the one who gives and takes away. All providence is from your hand, and that our duty is to submit to that, to believe that it is good, and to trust you. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.